Something incredible has arrived at Disney California Adventure Park.
Darling, I want action.
We're going big.
Elegance.
And we're going fast.
And speed.
The Incredicoaster is here and now open at Pixar Pier at Disney California Adventure Park. Bring your super family and your friends and come celebrate friendship and beyond at Pixar Fest before it ends September 3rd. Only at Disneyland Resort. Attractions and entertainment subject to change without notice.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media that is dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host, and during this broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat here on the EmotionalPro.com radio page or on our blogtalkradio.com/FPL page. That's for Full Power Living. You can also call us on our toll-free number, which is 800-630-7858. That's listed on the chat, 800-630-7858. So there's one thing we all have in common, each one of us, you and me. We're all getting older. If we're fortunate to stay on this earth, which most of us will long enough, we'll become aged and we'll eventually die. And these are things that most people don't like to think about, certainly don't like to address, but they're inevitable, and it's very good to prepare for them. And you know, here on Full Power Living, we don't hesitate to dive into those difficult-to-address issues. What's important to remember is that just as there are different ways to live, there are different ways to age and die, and our guest today specializes in helping people age happily and gracefully, prepare for and move through aging and illness, and to die. From all the people he's helped, Eric Shapiro learned important things about living, aging, illness, and death that can help you and me prepare better for what may come. He's here today to talk with us about ideas from his book, A New Wrinkle: What I Learned from Older People Who Never Acted Their Age. And you can find out more about that book at newwrinklebook.com. Eric Shapiro was a dentist for 30 years, and then he became a clinical gerontologist and health administrator. He counsels individuals and families and teaches positive affirmation, acceptance, and flexibility with respect to the aging process. He's author of more than 100 professional articles, a popular lecturer, and the mission of his book, A New Wrinkle, is to help people stay mentally and physically healthy while living longer, more productive lives. It's a guidebook for both parents and children who need to know about the aging process and how to confront the issues of aging. So, Eric Shapiro, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good. So as I mentioned, we're all getting older and facing death inevitably, but we're so unenthusiastic about looking at the issues surrounding this process. And I think as you have trained and worked as a clinical gerontologist, you face these issues daily for a living. So most of us are not wanting to face them at all. You do it daily. What's the difference between you and us?
It's a good question. You know, I see a lot of people in crisis. For an example, I had a young woman call me. She was in her 30s. Her dad had had a massive heart attack. He was about 60, and he was on life support. They didn't know what to do. They had found my card in his home, on his dresser, because he had taken my card maybe a year or two before when he was trying to deal with his mother, who had passed away before this happened to him. The children didn't know what to do, and they wanted to know if I could help them, if I can make the decisions for them. And I said, no, I can't do that. I'm not G-O-D, and I don't play G-O-D. So I said, the best thing you can do is to talk to the physician and have him or her help you with the prognosis and find out what they think about your dad recovering to his full self or partial self or be able to function in a quote-unquote normal manner. And if that's not possible, then call me and I will help you walk through the process of death and dying. And when you don't have time to prepare for this kind of a thing, you're not able to set up a proper grieving response or a grieving process. And I had this experience in 2008 when I went to China to teach hospice care and palliative medicine. And there was a huge earthquake there in 2008, if you remember, and over 300,000 people died. And the crux of the matter is that if we know somebody's chronically ill or they're in palliative care, which means they have a chronic illness and it's being maintained until they do go into hospice, we all have time to prepare for death and dying, and therefore we can set up a grieving process right then and there. And if we are lucky enough to afford counseling, or if we do get to have some kind of counseling, or we have people we can talk to, then we can process this in a way that will keep us from getting depressed. Otherwise, you're looking at PTSD, you're looking at post-traumatic stress disorder, when there is no time to prepare. And this is what I saw in China, and this is what I saw with these kids. There were three kids, 30, 25, and 17, from this gentleman that went into a coma due to a massive heart attack, and he didn't come out of it. So those kids had to make the decision to pull the plug, knowing full well that the father that they knew was not going to be the father that they had before, and that he was not going to make a difference to himself or other people anymore. There was no quality of life, and that's a key thing. So when I went to China, I was asked the same thing. The families tended to abandon the individual who was ill, and then the government said, well, what do we do? And, you know, again, I'm not G.O.D. This is an ethical and moral dilemma whereby you have to make a decision as to whether you can afford to keep this person alive. Is the person making a difference? And how do you want to deal with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that are in the same boat? They've got, you know, 2 billion people over there. So if you want to be callous about it, it may not make a difference to pull the plug on an 89-year-old man who's had a stroke, who can't talk, can't function, can't see, can't hear, and just lies there and has IV feeding tube and that kind of thing in there. But it's still a human life. And you know, you're going to run into a lot of dissension from people who are religious, who stand on their morals, who are concerned that, you know, we're doing something we shouldn't be doing. So most of the time I have the opportunity to help people go into the process with dignity and grace and be accepting. I didn't have that with my father. He was in an anger mode and never got out of it, so he didn't talk to anybody. And he would not tell us how he felt, and we were begging him to. So we really had no closure, none of us in my family. And the interesting thing was that I was so busy trying to take care of everything, I didn't have time to set up my own grieving process. And I had some post-traumatic stress around it. So my mother broke down. I had to be the guy that said, give my dad more morphine every hour, because he went from 250 pounds to 60 pounds. He had fulminating cancer all over his body, and he went into a coma, and he wasn't going to come out of it. My mother said, he's going to come out of it. That's total denial. But it was about a year later, and I wrote about this in my book, that I was called to see a patient of mine who was dying of cancer, and I went to the daughter's home, and the mother was in a bed with a quilt, with candles, with classical music, and she held me by the hand, and she told me how grateful she was for my care over the years as her dental person, and how much she appreciated me, and I told her how much I appreciated her, and it was just a beautiful setting, a beautiful scene, and something I had never experienced before, because she was very much at peace with dying. And I said my goodbyes, I hugged and kissed her, and she was in bed, and there were no tears at that point, but I went out to my car, I put my key in the ignition, and I never turned it on. I sat there and I cried for almost 2 hours, and that was basically not just for her, that was for my dad.
Right.
That broke loose the chains of emotion that were trapped inside. And after that, I could grieve.
Nice that you could let it go. You know, as you're talking, I become very...
I had
very
no choice.
Well, yes, it gets to a point like that when you build up enough pressure behind it. But I've been a psychotherapist for 40 years and have had to do, or have chosen to do, a lot of work on myself emotionally. And when my husband went into the hospital unexpectedly for 2 different weeks over the holidays just this past year, I was so grateful that I had done my own emotional work, because I was able to stay present and focused. But also, in addition, he has four daughters, and they all gathered around us and took care of both of us and came to the meetings and so forth. And what a wonderful thing it was. I'm really appreciating how wonderful it was that we all behaved in such a way. We split up the jobs that needed to be done. They helped us think through the processes or the decisions that needed to be made. They made sure that I had time away from the hospital. That's not usual in these matters. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's true, and it's what they showed was a great deal of compassion and empathy. And you know, those things have to be taught. So they learned that somewhere. It just that just doesn't happen. It's not innate. And I just gave a course on writing a legacy, and there were about 40 people of all different ages who took this class. And I did the same thing in China after this earthquake. And nobody knew what a legacy was, first of all. And I had them write their feelings down, and talk about who mattered to them, what mattered to them, how they wanted to be remembered, and that type of thing. And nobody gave me eye contact. And finally, I found one nurse that there were about 300 in the room. One looked up, and I said, "Okay, come on up here and read." And she read a legacy that she wrote as a projection of someone who died, a friend of hers who died in that earthquake. So she didn't write it as herself. She wrote it as a projection of her friend. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And then other people got up to read. And, you know, it's extremely important to respect other people's emotions, other people's situation. I just went through the death of a friend of mine. She was 64. And her husband was so bottled up with his emotions and so angry that there wasn't anything we could do to help in terms of showing compassion or care for him, because he rejected it. He just didn't know how to accept it. And that's the other half of the equation. You were at least astute enough to accept the empathic responses from these kids and the compassion that they were showing you, because you had the training.
Mm-hmm.
And that you were aware of what they were doing. And that's another thing. Most people aren't aware of how to act. There's so much fear around death and dying. And there doesn't have to be, because it's a beautiful part of life. I mean, it's an end stage, but we're all going to get there some way or another, by hook or by crook. I don't really, Woody Allen said, you know, "I don't mind dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens."
Right.
You know, nobody wants pain and suffering, and we all perceive that to be the case, and that's not always the case. If you can plan ahead, you know, that Boy Scout motto, be prepared. Plan your funeral, plan your death, plan your afterlife service, or your, you know, through writing a legacy about what you want, or making a movie or whatever. This is the best thing you can do.
That's so great. Yes. It was interesting, as my husband began to get ill, and he's 74 now, and he certainly wasn't thinking.
Guy.
Yes, he wasn't thinking about dying, and he's much better now. I will say that. But one of the things that I really valued, and I think this is another issue that comes up, is that he was willing to talk directly about what was going on with him, and we did, in fact, while he was ill, work together to set up. I have on my computer now a whole layout of what music he wants played at his funeral, who he wants to be there, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I think most people are not, you know, we only thought, gee, we should have done this sooner, you know, because you never know what's going to happen. But other than that, to have him be willing to face it, you know, both of us.
Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's hard to look at reality. It's like, you know, 90% of the boomers out there are in denial about getting older. We're in a fast-paced, fast-food kind of society, and people want instant gratification. That's all we think about. We don't think about getting older and death and dying and that process. You know, we know it's coming, but we don't want to think about it. So this is very uncomfortable for a lot of people, and I find that when it comes down to it, they go into this crisis mode, and as you know, as a therapist, and I do counseling as well, when people are highly emotional, they can't be rational. So it's very, very difficult for them to think about how to process a situation. I've got a woman now, I'm doing some work with her mother who's got dementia. She's 84, and the woman can't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
She just can't handle it. She's a very high-powered businesswoman. She's into her own thing and doesn't have time to deal or doesn't really want to deal with what her mother's going through. And it's what's happening is a decline of where her mother used to be because of the dementia process.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, okay, she's all yours, Eric. You do what you want to do, but I'll monitor everything. Well, you know, I'm caught between a rock and a hard place.
Right.
I'm caught between what the mother wants and what the daughter wants, and
mm-hmm.
they may not be the same thing. So that's a very difficult place for us to be in.
Well, now, that's an interesting thing I wanted to talk to you about. We had a neighbor who passed away maybe 5 years ago, 4 or 5 mm-hmm. years ago. He was 88, and his wife had died maybe 3 years earlier, and I used to go by and visit them almost every day when I would go out and walk my dog, and we became friends. Now, the man's name was Ed, and Ed, after a while, began to tell me that he didn't want to live any longer, that he wanted to go be with Betty, his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that I appreciated that he was finished. He was tired of being here, and that was so. But when I talked with his son, who was my age, who was in his mid-60s, when I talked with him, he said, I just lost my mother. I'm not ready to lose my dad. And I said to him, well, you know, at some point, I really think it would be a gift to your father for you to tell him that it's okay for him to die because he really is ready to die. And then I let it go. Well, about a month and a half later, I was out walking and the son came up to me and he said, it was a Wednesday. He said, I talked with my minister and she told me the same thing you told me. So yesterday I gave my father permission to die. By Saturday, Ed passed away. He just
mm-hmm.
was waiting for his son to let him
mm-hmm.
go.
That's a power of the mind also.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It's amazing, and it also it's like the question that arises in my mind is who do we pay attention to when somebody gets to the end of their life or they're aging or they're facing dying? Do we think about them or do we think about us?
Well, it works both ways. So I had an 88-year young gentleman who was probably the most brilliant man I've ever met. He had 4 PhDs. He went through the Holocaust. He escaped. He was studying the cognitive theories of mankind now, and people were coming from all over the world to sit with him because they knew he was not well. His wife had Alzheimer's disease to the point where she was just about bedridden and was dying herself, and he had told me that he felt he had lost all of his dignity because he couldn't even cook for himself anymore or do some of the activities of daily living, the ADLs that all of us normally do for the most part. And so he wanted to die. He wanted to take his own life, but he didn't want to leave his wife alone. He wanted her to go first, number one. The other thing was that I said, well, don't you realize you have dignity, that you have your life, you're able to function, you can still think. You can still bring pleasure to the people that love and respect you around you. And I'm not talking about people like me. I'm talking about people like your son and your daughter and your grandchildren who come to visit you on a weekly basis. And he said, well, that's the gimmick on which I'm living.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, you know, as much as I want to die, I don't want to deny them of the pleasure of my company when I mean so much to them. See, that's the other aspect of it. He's extremely bright.
Mm-hmm.
And he reversed the whole thing the whole premise of which you just told me about this gentleman and his father.
Mm-hmm.
So it works both ways. It's just a matter of choice.
Mm-hmm. And boy, that choice is really important.
Absolutely, and that's all we have, Eileen, is choice in our life.
Uh-huh.
And when we make that choice, we hopefully are responsible for that choice. And
yes,
and he knew that, you know, at any moment in time he could just go finish himself off. He had the medication to do it or the means to do it, but he didn't want to deny his family the pleasure of his existence, you know, until he lost his final breath in a natural way, which happened, you know, eventually.
You know, we're up to our first break right now, Eric, and that's something I'd like to look at a little more closely, which is like my husband is retiring as a neurosurgeon right now, and he has been really struggling because he's known himself for 45 years as a neurosurgeon, and he doesn't feel like he has a lot of worth outside of that. And I know several people who are in that position. So let's talk about a person's sense of worth as their identity needs to change or their role needs to change when we come back.
Okay.
All right. So we're talking today with clinical gerontologist and author Eric Shapira, whose book is called A New Wrinkle. You can find out more about that book at newwrinklebook.com or more about Eric Shapira and his services at agingmentorservices.com. Coming up next on Full Power Living, we'll talk about the changing of roles and sex and dating in the older years. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes, or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. This is Eileen Dillon. I have a few announcements. Next week on March 8th, Barry Spector will be here to explore the myth of American innocence. He uses myth to understand why, even though we've been a country for a while and we've done some pretty non-innocent things, we still believe in the myth of American innocence and what effect that has on us. Upcoming guests are listed at the top of our radio show page on emotionalpro.com, and we hope that you don't miss a single episode of Full Power Living. Remember, you can talk with us right now, toll free at 800-630-7858, or pose a question or comment on either of our chats. And should you miss a live program, remember that you can subscribe on iTunes, or you can listen to the archived show on either Blog Talk Radio or Emotional Pro. We want to thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. We've been talking today with Eric Shapira, a dentist turned clinical gerontologist, about ideas from his book, A New Wrinkle, What I Learned from Older People Who Never Acted Their Age. So, Eric, I imagine that especially because our baby boomers are going into their older years, that we're going to be hearing more about clinical gerontology, and I want to ask you to just tell us what it is that you do. What is a clinical gerontologist?
That's funny you should say that, because most people don't know what a gerontologist is. I had a reporter call me and wanted to ask about my book. She said, what's a gerontologist? And I said, oh, that's a caveman that deals with dinosaurs. You know, she didn't know. People can't pronounce it, let alone define what it is. So I just tell people I'm an aging specialist, which I am. Clinical gerontology is the study of aging, but clinically, I'm hands-on, sort of like a licensed clinical social worker would be. I do assessments and counseling, and my degree had a caveat with an emphasis on counseling psych. And I do a lot of phone counseling as well. I have a certificate in that from Stanford Medical School. And so there's a lot of different things I do, and I use my medical dental background as well in doing assessments and being a patient advocate. So if you go to my website, you can see a lot of things that I do there. And they're not traditional, but there are things that I'm comfortable doing and have command over doing. So.
And the website is agingmentorservices.com.
Right, mm-hmm. And I'm also a teacher, so I instruct and I teach classes in healthy aging, and I've been doing a lot of lecturing on aging and oral systemic disease and the connection between the two.
What's oral systemic
disease?
Oh, like you would deal with if you were a dentist, yes.
Or, any kind of a physician would deal with that as well.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. All right, that's not a
We know for a fact that periodontal disease has progressed to the point where it sends cytokines out, inflammatory byproducts into the system that can cause insulin resistance and potentiate diabetes. We know that it can cause heart disease. We know that it can increase plaque formation in arteries. We know it can cause kidney disease and early pregnancies in people. We know that different types of bacteria can adhere to denture bases. So if they're not cleaned properly, by soaking the denture, then some of those things can be aspirated, and those bacteria or fungi can cause lung diseases such as pneumonia. So there's lots of different aspects of the oral cavity that can be manifested in the systemic system of our bodies.
That sounds like a whole other program. I was not aware of all that, although I do
time.
Know. So what we're really saying is we really need to pay attention to the health of
Absolutely.
Our mouth and teeth and gums, which a lot of people don't do. Yeah.
And actually, as we age, our ability to fight infection diminishes. Our inflammatory response mechanisms are decreased, especially if you're medically compromised.
Mm-hmm.
So it's even more difficult in the long run. So that is another program.
Yeah. So I mentioned before the break that my husband at age 74 has been retiring from his neurosurgery practice, and I think that probably what kicked him off into his medical issues over the holidays. But it's been really difficult for him because he worked really hard, like most of us. He worked really hard to get to be a neurosurgeon, then he practiced for 45 years, and now he has to give it up. And the big issue for him, and I run across this with other people that I work with in my practice, is who am I if I'm not who I thought myself to be all these years?
Absolutely.
How do you help people transition from transition?
I use myself as an example because I went through that same thing your husband's going through, and it's sometimes people are in denial about it. I actually had a client who lost his job after 40 years. He worked in the trucking industry, he was in management, and he moped around for over a year, depressed and not having a job, and therefore his self-esteem went down the tubes with it. And I found, looking in the mirror one day at myself, who am I? I used to be a dentist. And the epiphany I realized that we have a tendency, we all basically as human beings, we're fallible, and we have a tendency to identify ourselves by what we do and not who we are. So your husband needs to understand that he is, what's his first name?
Bob.
Okay, he needs to understand that he is Bob, and he always was Bob. And Bob has metamorphed. Bob has gone through different cycles and transitions in life, but he's still the same old Bob he was, back in high school and all through his college and medical days and his practice days. He hasn't. He's changed maybe physically in appearance, but he's still the same old Bob inside. He's probably 18 inside, and so. I came to that realization that I'm Eric Shapira. Nobody can take that away from me, and I have certain skill sets that are very valuable, as does your husband. And I started a long while back, but I've been doing a lot of humanitarian work, and I don't think people realize what gifts they have until they give them away.
Amen.
And I think that it's really important for people to give of themselves, give their gifts away, teach people,
mm-hmm.
show people,
mm-hmm.
love people, do things. Whether you get paid for it or not, I think it's a really important mantra in giving back. It's the price we pay for the space that we occupy.
Right. That is brilliant. One of the people that I've been looking at this with is a client of mine who's also in his 70s, and he grew up in a very wealthy family, so he has had no need to have an occupation or a job in his life.
He's lucky.
Well, yes and no.
In that sense,
we all have our burdens.
Yes, we do.
Well, the issue for him now is that he feels like he's never done anything useful in this life, though he almost got a PhD in divinity. But he is a very loving man, and he's living in a low-income housing unit with some other people. And everybody, every place he goes, people love him. They feel better because he's been there. And I keep trying to get the message through to him that he doesn't have to do something. All he has to do is be, because he is of worth just by sharing his loving heart.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And the Strucker guy, he lost his self-esteem. He lost his identity because it was so attached to what he was doing in life. People say now to me, what do you do? And I just say, when? I do a lot of different things. And I've diversified. I've reinvented myself. I've learned how to paint. I was a sculptor for 40 years. And some of that I can't do, carve marble like I used to because of my neck. But I learned how to paint, and I taught myself that. I'm self-taught. And if you can imagine it, you can create it. And I would tell that to Bob, and he needs to sit down and with somebody like me or you or somebody maybe not as close as you and brainstorm to the deepest depths of his brain as to what he might want to do that's creative for him, that will bring him some pleasure and some self-esteem, some continued self-esteem. You know, we're used to seeing patients as doctors, and we're used to getting gratification from the results of what we know and what we do, at least for the most part. Sometimes we have our failures, but in dentistry it's more of an instant gratification than it might be in neurosurgery. But either way, you look for positive results, and when you don't have that anymore, there's nothing to validate your skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
And so he needs to find something that will validate him in terms of, teaching or learning something new or going back to school and learning a new profession. I did that. I actually was studying gerontology for 10 years before I left dentistry. I was teaching it in school, and I wanted more credibility doing it. So I went back and got the master's degree. I was teaching geriatric dentistry for years.
Wow. Well, let me just add in here that he was a prodigy on the piano as a child. He loves playing and listening to music. He is a wonderful lecturer. He's had several articles published. He's a wonderful writer. He has so many skills, and he also goes on the internet and offers advice to people in brain tumor lists and various places where he can be of help. So it's not like he doesn't know these things. It's a difference, I think, in knowing what you can do and identifying that that has value.
Well, back up to our previous discussion, he's absorbing the loss in the retirement phase of his life, and therefore he's stuck in that. If you're stuck in a grieving process too long, you get depressed, and you got to break that cycle. You got to break the cycle. So, he needs some counseling around this, and he, I'd love to meet the guy because he sounds fascinating. But besides that fact, he needs his head turned around, and nobody can do it for him except him. But you need to show him the way. If you don't know the way, any road will take you there, thanks to Yogi Berra and his great philosophy. it's when you get to the why in the road, take it. One of those things, like, what do I do? The road less traveled or the road, that everybody's tromping on? But again, it goes back to being a matter of choice. And I think that we need that sense of self-worth that to maintain our dignity. And here's this trucker who, after a year and a half, finally gets a job, and the morning of reporting to the job, he gets up, and after a year and a half of sitting on the couch slugging down beers and eating potato chips, he has a heart attack and he dies.
Oh my gosh!
And so in the coffin, his wife lays the job acceptance letter, which is what he hung his hat on. That's the most important thing in life, right there. And she lays that on him in a coffin and has a nervous breakdown because for a year and a half, he really didn't relate to his wife or his family, and there was no showing of appreciation or sharing of emotions, or he kept it all bottled in. So that's the worst thing you can do, the worst thing.
It's really, really hard on the people, like the children or the spouses of the person who's having difficulties or illness or depression. It's very difficult when just even a matter of like physical touch or reaching out or connection. I've had some experience with that myself and realize how hard it is. We've done a few other shows in past years on aging, and my takeaway from those interviews is that there are a couple of ways we can go about the process of dying, that a lot of people get ill fairly early on and then have these kind of chronic illnesses until they finally reach death, and other people go gangbusters up until a year and a half or 2 years before they die, and then they have things go wrong with them. And in thinking about that, I wanted to ask you, and I know this is a big area, is there an ideal way to die?
Well, I think everybody's an individual, and it's going to be different for everyone in terms of their own personal experience. I think if people can educate themselves on the dying process and the different ways to die, I think, you know, then they might have a better choice as to how they want to die themselves, if they have a choice. If, you know, the big one hits them, then they get the widowmaker, they won't have to worry about that. But I think the best thing to do is be prepared. Have all your documents in order, your durable power of health care and your power of attorney and your will and your trust and your legacy and anything, you know, that you want other people to know about, you ought to put it down in paper and make sure more than one person knows where it is.
And let me point out that each one of those things is defined and described in your book.
I have a good friend who's an undertaker here in town on the Half Moon Bay Coast side, and where I live, and every time I go in to make my arrangements, he breaks down. And, you know, we've known each other for 40 years. We love each other. He's a great guy. We're both, you know, students of the Vietnam War and era, and he doesn't want to think about death and dying. And that's his thing projected onto me, because we've both seen enough of it in the past. He doesn't want to think about me dying, and so then I can't get my stuff done. So now I'm going to have to make some demands on here. This is what I want. You know, you better do this, or I'm going somewhere else, as much as I love the guy. So
yeah.
I think you have to be your own proactive person when it comes to this kind of thing, and not
Absolutely.
Wait for somebody to do it for you. When my dad died, he hadn't done this, and we had nothing. And, you know, before this legacy class that I taught at the beginning of the week, I was free thinking. I was just letting my brain go. And I remembered the attorney who came to the house after the funeral, and he looked at myself and my brother and my sister, and he said, you know, your father didn't leave you anything, in that tone of voice.
I
said, okay, I'm not taking anything away from my mother. Whatever he left, he can, you know, he didn't leave anything. But the point was that he did leave something. He left a lot of things. His legacy was what he taught us, and the way he acted, and the way he functioned in life. He was a good person. He left us a lot, and that really hit me that morning. It really struck me that has stuck with me for, I don't know, 50 years or 40 years, 40 some years, and it came out that morning when I was going to teach this class. So it's just letting your mind go. When you want to think about death and dying, think about all the people that you knew that died before you and how you want to make it different for yourself. I think that's a good thing to do.
That's great. Well, over time, our long-time spouses die, and we've got a lot of widows and widowers, and they might not want to remarry because they'll lose their benefits. But we still have needs for intimacy, and we have sexual feelings and desires, and people look for companions. Now, one of the things you mentioned in A New Wrinkle that I find interesting, I've just begun to see it in the media, is how prevalent sexually transmitted diseases are in our older population. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Yeah, well, people may not be, quote unquote, in circulation, if you will, for some time because they were married or because they weren't able to have sex for some reason or other. But with the advent of the erectile dysfunction drugs, men are able to become boys again and can partake of festivities, sexual festivities. And so I advocate relearning Sex 101 and learning what you need to do to protect yourself and your partner, because there's about a 30% increase in sexually transmitted diseases, and that's anything from, you know, galloping dandruff to gonorrhea to even syphilis now, and herpes and that type of thing.
It's HIV also,
and
right?
Definitely HIV.
Yeah.
And I've got a 96-year young mother-in-law who was having phone sex with a 101-year-old man. And I usually start my lectures out on sex with this example. This is for real. And he had a heart attack on the phone. And they've been doing this for about a year. And he died. And we don't know if it's something she said or the phone shorted out his pacemaker.
Oh, my gosh.
But one way or the other, he bit the dust and left her holding her own, so to speak. And so now she said she wants a 70-year-old man. She thinks they're more sustainable. It's quite humorous. So inside of her, she feels, you know, that she's 25 years young, and the sex urge hasn't diminished. But it's in terms of the intimacy that she's looking for. She wants. I'll give you another example. She used to live in Tucson, and she belonged to a swimming pool there. And she was in her 80s, middle to high 80s, and a man wanted to show her his butterfly collection, and she thought it was a come on, which it might have been. I don't know. And so she rebuffed him, and then she saw him again a week or two later, and he came up to her, and he said, you know, I still want to show you my butterfly collection. And she said, will you leave me alone? He said, well, I'll leave you alone. I just want to tell you how beautiful you are, and you have the most beautiful breasts on a woman of your stature I've ever seen in my life, and a great figure. And so she shooed him away, and I said, come on. I said, you have to be complimented at your stage in life that somebody would recognize your beauty, your external beauty anyway. And she said, yes, I was. So down deep, you know, we all have that need for intimacy, and I define intimacy in the book as into me see.
Mm-hmm.
It's allowing others to see parts of you that you don't really talk about or express or share with other people too much. And she's pretty intimate with me in terms of what she says about her wants and her desires, because she doesn't have a lot of people to talk to, and she wants me to know this kind of information because she thinks I'm going to write another book and it's going to be about her.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually writing a book about sex, but over 60, and it's going to be an interesting book. But this, you know, there are other people I've interviewed. I've interviewed a lot of people about sex, people in their 80s, octogenarians. One guy, I walked up to him, I said, I'm doing a survey, and I'd like to know if you still have sexual relations with your wife. And he said, yes, and she loves it. We have sex every day. I almost dropped my jaw on the floor and broke it. I said, are you kidding? You know, because I'm comparing him to me.
Right,
and
right.
I don't do that. And he said, yeah, my wife has dementia, and, you know, every day we have sex, it's a new day. Because you don't remember from day to day.
Oh, my God.
there's no pressure, if you will.
Uh-huh.
As if, you know, you'd be bugging your wife or your husband to have sex with you day in, day out. It's going to get old.
Uh-huh.
But with that type of scenario, it's a new day.
I know a woman who's now in her 90s who at 65 told me that she retired from sex because she reached the age of 65 and her husband could retire, so she could too.
Mm-hmm.
And not too long after that, her husband died.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years following that, she remarried at the age of 84.
Yeah.
And I was with her one time. We were posing for pictures, and everybody usually says cheese, and I heard her standing next to me going, sex, sex. And I turned to her and said, that amazes me. I thought you'd given it up. And she said that her new husband said it was just for fun, and she looked like a schoolgirl. And so it was like the whole role of sexuality had been redefined for her, even at that age, which was great. Well, we're up to a break.
It's a very common thing, Eileen. It's It's very common, believe it or not.
Oh, great. Well, it was lovely to hear, I have to say. We're up to a break, Eric.
Okay.
We're talking today with clinical gerontologist and author Eric Shapira. His book is called A New Wrinkle. You can find out more about it at newwrinklebook.com. It's also available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And he also has another site, agingmentorservices.com. Ask your question now on the chat or call us toll-free, 800-630-7858. I see you guys on the chat, so come on, ask a question. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Everybody feels anger, but if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com. We are back here on Full Power Living with clinical gerontologist and author Eric Shapira as our guest. His book is entitled A New Wrinkle, What I Learned from Older People Who Never Acted Their Age. So, Eric, my sister died in 2005 here. She spent her last 7 months with us in our home at the age of 64, and I learned from her that life doesn't always go on the way we expect it to, that there's an end, and it stimulated me to get on to the many projects and experiences I want to complete. I took a 2-month vacation and cruise, and I started a new business. And a big part of what you're focused on in A New Wrinkle is the wisdom that you have garnered from people. Will you tell us some of the wisdom that's been most profound for you?
Yes. When I had the epiphany about who I was or wasn't at the time, and I wanted to move forward, I really felt it was important to live in the now, and that's a key thing. And it reminds me of the woman that was shot, and the headline said, the woman was shot in the East Bay and the bullet was in her yet. And I went into the dictionary and I couldn't find where the yet was as part of your anatomy, so I'm still questioning where the now is. So I think we need to live in the present moment. And there's a really good quote I put in my book by Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Buddhist monk. Breathing in, I calm body and soul. Breathing out, I smile. Living in the present moment, I know that this is the only moment. And that I find a lot of soothing peace in. I think that, you know, if we project too much into the future and it doesn't happen, we're going to be disappointed, which leads to anger, if you will, or guilt or frustration and depression. And if we live too much in the past, it can do the same thing. We have regrets. And we're paying rent to all this baggage that keeps us paralyzed from enjoying the present moment. So I really think living in the now is a great thing. I had to look back at my relatives, especially my mother was an only child, so I had my father's brothers and sisters, whomever were left out of the 10 or 12 brothers and sisters that he had to look back on, and the things that they taught me while I was going to school back east. because I went back there to try to get to know them, and some of the principles that they taught me, you know, to be committed to what I was doing, to be honest, to be open, to be caring, to be a good listener is a gift that not only you have for yourself, but to share with other people. That's the best gift you can share, is being a good listener and allowing someone to feel and to express what they feel. So all these things that I learned helped me benchmark myself for my future as a gerontologist. Not that I wasn't doing it as a dentist, but I'm doing it in a different way. I'm still a caregiver. Mm-hmm. I'm just doing it as in a different aspect of that, and that's what I would want for your husband Bob to look at, and you know, just shift role shifting a little bit, and mm-hmm. taking what he knows, his empathy, his skill, his knowledge levels, and maybe tweaking it in a different direction. So
yeah,
and those things, you know, look back at the elders in your life. I had a woman who was in her 80s that I knew for at least 15 years, who was an artist and a poet, and she was constantly, because I write poetry, and she was constantly pushing me to concentrate on my art as an expression of my own emotion. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but it really helped me be whole.
Mm-hmm.
If you're only living with part of yourself, you can't be a whole person. And I realized that a lot of these old-timers were, you know, whatever they had was right there on their shirt sleeves. They're wearing it there, and that's who they are, and they tell it to you the way it is. And we don't see that today. As I said, we're in such a fast-food, fast-paced society. People don't have time to talk about their feelings for the most part. I mean, how many friends do you have? You can count them on your fingers, you know, one hand. How many people will sit and talk to you and listen to you and your concerns and respond empathetically rather than telling you to go take an aspirin for your headache, which is a sympathetic response? It's those things that I learned from older people have helped me be a whole person.
Right. I just want you to know that I fire people as friends if they won't sit and listen to me and my feelings.
Absolutely. I've done that. I've done that, Eileen. I've done it.
Yeah.
And if you have a significant emotional experience in life, and I talk about this in the book, you know, like a divorce or a death or a loss of something or something that creates change in your life. I took the first letters of those three words, significant emotional experience. You see things differently. That's what it spells out, see. Mm-hmm. It changes your life and your perspective. And I have fired people, just like you said, who were supposedly my quote-unquote friends who weren't my friends because
mm-hmm.
they didn't take the time to share their listening skills with me. It was always one-sided, and I don't want to be with people like that. So I think we have to make a choice on who we want to be with, how we want to mold our lives, and which direction we want to go in. I think those things are really, really important.
Well, you know, for many years, I just want to put this out. I was really terrified of death and dying. I had come close to dying several times as a young child, and I'd really grabbed onto life. And then about 35 years ago, my first husband's grandmother, whose name was Helen, went through the process of dying, and I really loved her, and I spent a lot of time with her, and she introduced me to the death and dying process. And I learned a few things from her, like there comes a point for most people where they're ready to die. They embrace dying. And we also talked candidly about what she was going through. And I ended up finding that the time I spent with her, listening to her and talking with her about the death process that she was going through, that was absolutely exhilarating. And I don't know that most people realize that it has that potential.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. Because you're getting into somebody else's head and you're looking at a different thinking process than your own. You're giving them the opportunity to tell you how they feel. It's an extremely intimate moment. And, you know, all we have is our belief systems and our thoughts when we do that in words, and our words are manifested by our actions, and those actions become habits, and the habits become values, and the values become our destiny. And if we don't have people to experience life with, then, you know, there's nothing worth living for. I mean, I think we really need to be aware of the process of communication in living our lives to the fullest. And if we don't have that, we don't have much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really good part of the learning process about yourself, is being able to communicate, be a good listener, and be a good sounding board. As I said at the end of my book, we all need our mirrors. we need people to reflect our feelings with, and that helps us learn more about ourselves and validate who we are. It's a validation process.
And I've had a number of people. I had a friend here just 2 or 3 years ago who was 98 when she passed away. A number of people at the end of life tell me, I'm ready to go, but my husband or my wife or my son or daughter, they don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
And that seems like another part of the listening.
That's denial. That's denial. You know, and that comes from fear and from not knowing. You know, the fear of public speaking is number one on the list in the world. Number two is the fear of dying.
Uh-huh.
And it's because it's the fear of the unknown, you know. And when you're in public speaking, you're standing in front of other people, you're exposed.
Yes, you are.
And you can't hide anything. And the same thing with the death and dying process, sometimes you may not be there and you're totally exposed again. So there's loss of control. And if you look at the human animal, we're into control. We're all about control. It's giving up that control that's really, really an interesting process. And it allows you to free associate. And I think that's when you learn the most about yourself.
Mm, that's really lovely. It's like, in my mind, it's like returning to a childhood state where we allow ourselves to free associate without any difficulty.
You're nurturing your inner child, and I think that's the secret of successful long life and happiness is to live your inner child. It gets pushed down inside of us,
mm-hmm.
and our inner child is that nascent imp, the curiosity that we all had as children, the spontaneity, the ability to say and think what we feel, and you know that gets pushed down inside when we are succumbed to the morals and the rules and the restrictions and the limitations that are placed on us as we grow older.
Hmm.
We need to revisit that place.
Well, it's time for us to stop the program now, so why don't we invite everyone...
I'm having too good a time, Eileen.
Oh, thank you. I am too. Why don't we invite everyone who's listening, including you and me, to go forward today being our own nascent imp and being as spontaneous as we can possibly be today.
That's a
good way to end, huh?
Well, yes, I
do want to thank you for practicing what you preach. You know, when you ran into the roadblock that you couldn't practice as a dentist, you reinvented yourself and allowed yourself to continue to be empathetic and benevolent and caring, some of the things you learned from those relatives you were talking about as you became a clinical gerontologist. And I think we really need the information that you've packaged in a new wrinkle. And
thank you.
So I want to thank you for writing it. I want to thank you for being in this world with me and for your many contributions and also for being here on Full Power Living with us today.
I thank you very much for your comments and for your great show. I think it's a great thing for people.
Wonderful. Thank you, Eric.
You're welcome, Eileen.
Next week on March 8, we're talking with Barry Spector about the myth of American innocence. Join us live every Thursday, 9 a.m. Pacific and noon Eastern time for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. And again, our thanks to Eric Shapira. Paul Johnston, also Fresh Talk Media. He's our producer and fantastic support person and leader. So thank you, Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
When billionaires support Adam Laxalt, they get tax cuts for big business and efforts to loosen pollution regulations. Here's what we get. Education cuts, contaminated water, and leniency on big drug companies. Don't let Adam Laxalt sell out our families to the highest bidder. When billionaires support Adam Laxalt, they get tax cuts for big business and efforts to loosen pollution regulations. Here's what we get. Education cuts, contaminated water, and leniency on big drug companies. Don't let Adam Laxalt sell out our families to the highest bidder.